So welcome to, it's day three already, because we had the evening on Friday, so it's day three of the retreat. And I thought I would just, start off with just saying a little bit about what the session is going to be today, this morning. Though plans can always change, so I'll say what it is, but it may be that when it actually comes down to it, I'll decide, actually. So I'm going to follow my heart and go with what feels right in the moment. But at the moment, at this point, the plan is that I give a talk or ramble around the second line, do not betray your heart. And for reasons which hopefully will be clearer, I then want us to do a ritual, another but different Buddha puja taken from the Dhammapada. Then we'll probably have a silent tea break, and then after that, end the session with meditation. So quite often we do like meditation followed by ritual, but actually I think it can work quite well to do ritual and then after that meditate. So that's what we're going to do today. Do not cheat the Buddha. Do not betray your heart. Do not deceive living beings. Three quite simple lines, but they've got a lot in them. And actually, the more that I think about them, reflect on them, the more things come to me around them. And I think it was interesting in the question and answers yesterday. It came up that, you know, for some people there's quite a reaction around the fact that it's telling us what we shouldn't do. And that it felt maybe a little bit unlike how often teachings are presented, particularly like with the precepts, the ethical precepts we live by. They're very much not commandments, that they're more kind of like training principles or principles we apply to our lives and seen as a practice that we get better at it, get more ethical, more skillful, more aware. But in any situation, we've got the basic principle and then we try and apply it as best we can. Whereas this is very much don't do this, you know. But I think there's something that's good about that clarity, and also that it, if we have a reaction, then we have that opportunity to unpack what we're reacting to and what might be the underlying conditioning and views that it's stirring up. And I also think there's something about any teaching. We just take it loosely in a way. The Buddha said, you know, don't trust the teachers, don't trust the teachings. In a way, you just like test it against your experience, see what works. So I think we all need to come into our own relationship with the Dharma and with all the practices. So we probably will all have our own way into exploring these three lines. So yesterday, Maitri Pushpa started us off on do not cheat the Buddha. And one of the things she was saying was that those lines come from a meditation manual, which looks at practice and practice in terms of body, speech and mind. And that those particular lines are in a section focusing on the body. So I found that quite interesting that that comes in terms of the body. But of course, you know, we can approach every area of practice through the body, the heart, the mind, and actually there we always are, all three of them, but sometimes there's more of a focus on one or the other. Um, And she also looked at different ways of cheating. You know, what does the Buddha mean to us? What does cheating mean to us? Some of the things that came up were like not being true to ourselves, not taking the not given, not faking something. Selling ourselves short was something she came up with a lot when we're not actually doing the best we can or being true to ourselves. So it very much leads into the line that I'm going to be looking at, the do not betray your heart. But I was thinking, actually, in early Buddhism, particularly if you look at the Pali text and things like the Dhammapada, it can be quite directive, quite, you should do this, you shouldn't do that. And almost but a lot more black and white in how it's expressed. And also in that, there's a lot about trying not to do things that might be frowned upon or judged by the wise. So again, that was something that Maitri Pushpa brought up about, having respect for the wise or for those further along the path or the, people like the Buddha. And that one way of cheating is not to show respect to the Buddha and to ourselves and to other practitioners in a way. She also talked about generosity as being like another the other side of cheating. So in a way, when she talked about not being what do you call it? Selling ourselves short. There's a sort of holding back there. So actually giving more of ourselves, generosity in terms of ourselves, our time, energy, all the different ways we're encouraged to give. That was a way, in a way, the other side of how she was seen cheating. And I did just want to say, like, well, the word heart. You know, it has different con. It's one of those words that's got so many layers of meaning and symbol, and about that we all have our own different associations with it. But certainly, in everyday life, heart is often seen as very much around emotion. Well, there's the physical heart that keeps us alive and is pumping the blood around our bodies, but it's also seen very much as associated with feelings and emotions, and seen as separate. You know, you've got, so when we make these distinctions of mind, heart, and body, they're just a way of think seeing things, but it's not really true. And certainly from Buddhism, you have this word citta, which basically includes both the heart and the mind. Maitri Pushpa sometimes used the word heart, mind, and the idea of awakening. You know, in Buddhism, there's the awakening bodhicitta, is the awakening heart or the awakening mind. You could translate it equally as either, and it includes both. So for me, also, when we're talking about the heart in this context, I'm not seeing it as separate from our minds. Okay, so that's just a little bit of recapping. You know, we also looked at some of the qualities of the Buddha, and in the ritual yesterday, I did that reading, that old reading, description of some of his qualities. So for me, the do not cheat, I mean, do not betray your heart. It's not that I'm not trying to betray the sort of physical heart, though obviously there's a whole area around self-metta and looking after ourselves and self-care and care of our bodies, where that may come into it. But it's more about, well, what are the things that are most important to me, that I value the most? Heart's longing, the things that inspire me, that I aspire to. So we have this word shraddha, that's in Pali, maybe the same in Sanskrit, which is often translated as faith or confidence. And it's very much associated with us resonating with, I suppose, spiritual values, spiritual qualities, things that are meaningful to us, and our response to that. And it's seen as a very key part of practice that we do have that response in a way that inspires us and keeps us going when things are tough, you know, that there's something that's deeply meaningful for that we recognize, not always consciously, but it's there. It's sort of like part of a path that we're following. So I thought I'd just quote Sangha Rajita when he's talking a little bit about Shraddha and how that relates to the Buddha and the Dharma and the qualities of enlightenment in ourselves. When we're confronted by some embodiment of enlightenment, either in the form of an image, a literary description, even a living person, most of all by a living person, then the response, what we call the emotional response, is really the response of our potential to the Buddha's actual enlightenment. There's something deep down within us which has a sort of affinity with what is fully realized, fully expressed, fully achieved in that embodiment of enlightenment. There's a sort of kinship. It's rather like two musical instruments. You strike one, and the other musical instrument by its side starts vibrating in unison, as it were. So when we are confronted by this sort of embodiment of enlightenment, we respond because deep down in us there is that capacity, that potentiality for enlightenment. So we respond in that way. Faith, we may say, is the response, the real living response of the whole being, and especially the emotional part of our being to something we may not be able to have a clear idea about conceptually or intellectually, but something we intuitively perceive, which we feel, if you like, is greater, higher, nobler, more sublime, and more worthwhile, of higher value than ourselves as we are now. Something to which we could, as it were, dedicate ourselves, if you like, surrender ourselves. And he also goes on to say that the word Shraddha, the word, you know, when you translate it, the links of it based about where you place the heart, to place the heart upon. So Shraddha is our response to values that we place a heart upon, to symbols, teachings, peoples that represent those values, those qualities. So I think for myself, way before I was a Buddha, there was that going on. You know, there were certain things, even as a young child, that I responded to that really moved me. You know, whether it was nature, whether it was a piece of music, whether it was maybe a picture, maybe it was just something that seemed true, something that seemed real, or something that seemed beautiful, and outside of my everyday experience and what was going on in my life and going on in my family or school or whatever, I'd have those moments. And you know, I suppose, or you could call them like peak experiences sometimes, where I would enter into a different kind of reality or feel a different kind of connection or interconnection with others in the world. So for a lot of the time that was through arts, and sometimes it was through people, and sometimes it was through nature at that time. And then later on, when I started on a sort of path of self-healing, self-development, and became a lot more conscious maybe of the something more spiritual, even though at that time I wasn't thinking in those terms, I think that was a thread that I was following. Yeah. If I look at the themes in my life, the things that have been important, there has been something about truth, being authentic, seeing below the surface to what feels real, you know. I've always, you know, whether it's a painting, whether it's somebody doing a dance, piece of music, comic, whatever, when somebody sort of captures something real about a person or about an interaction, That always spoke to me. Anyway, so quite often, though, all those the things that are most important to us, we kind of either don't listen to, or we learn not to listen to, or not to show to other people. Sometimes because of how they respond, they might not understand, or they might be a bit dismissive. They might even ridicule it, or and that can feel really, really painful. And you kind of maybe learn to hide away that sort of precious, vulnerable part of ourselves that what we most value. Particularly if it doesn't seem to be in tune with what's around us. There are sort of expectations and ways of being that may not quite fit in with that, where, how we are all through our lives. And there's certain qualities, aren't there? There's certain things that may not be valued so much in greater society, people who are very charismatic, who've got a lot of energy, who achieve a lot, those often get a lot more respect than someone who's just gets on with their ordinary life, and maybe they're kind, maybe they're a good listener, maybe they're there for other people, and yet the more and more I live my life, the more I think kindness is sort of like the fundamental quality that I would like to cultivate more in myself, and I really value in others. So, do not betray your heart. I think there's lots of ways throughout my life that I have betrayed my heart, and I think there's lots of ways that I've also tried to listen to my heart and follow its teachings. And I think the more we try to listen, the more space we do, the more we follow that path, then the clearer it becomes. Sometimes Paramananda, who's a teacher at West London, sometimes talks about us having a calling, an inner calling, and do we listen to that voice? And it's not always clear, I think. So we need to actually create the time and the space to allow it to speak to us, to allow ourselves to listen to it. So some of being true to a heart is actually being able to see what's there, and also to see what we're doing, see who we are. And recognize when we're not being true to our heart, and recognize when we are. And I think for me, actually Pushpa linked these three lines to the three jewels of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And it occurred to me yesterday that you could also equally link them to the threefold path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And ethics, from a Buddhist point of view, is interesting because what makes an action skillful or ethical is the underlying motivation, intention, and the mental emotional state behind the action. So it's not the action itself. The same action from two people, from one person might be seen as skillful, and from another person not. And underlying that, the basic criteria are, is this action coming from a place of ill will or hatred, aversion? Is it coming from a place of attachment, craving, greed, clinging? And is it coming from a place of delusion, views, conditioning, spiritual ignorance? So that's the sort of, if it's coming more from the way things are, from an honest place, then that's where we're cultivating the wisdom, and the ethics is becoming from a place of kindness, generosity, compassion. then that's also what makes it more skillful. And so when we're listening to our heart, we can sort of think of it in terms of actually this is part of our ethical practice, is actually being true to our heart. And trying not to come from a place that harms ourselves or harms others, but instead is beneficial to ourselves and towards others. So in some ways you could just see the path, the Buddhist path, as we're trying to cultivate more awareness and insight, and we're trying to cultivate more kindness and compassion. You know, there's all the different teachings, all the practices, but basically it seems to me that's what it comes down to. Yeah. And this line, "Do not betray your heart," to me is very much linked to that. So, yeah, another thing Maitri Bhujpa said yesterday was that we're so very good at rationalizing, justifying our actions. We don't want to, we can find ways to justify us doing what we want to do, not doing what we don't want to do. But that's not always being honest. Yeah, that's not always listening. That's not always, sometimes it is cheating the Buddha, sometimes it's betraying our heart. So, looking back on my own life, I'm thinking, sometimes I've betrayed my heart by not doing what I know is most important, or not allowing myself to pursue something that I know is meaningful to me and important to me. I think I was lucky enough that actually I'd loved music, it was on the radio, and I had all these very strong responses, particularly to classical music, because that was the only music we had on at home. But then later, when I discovered other forms of music, to those well. But I was lucky enough that, my brother, my sister and I, we went to Saturday morning music school and we learned instruments. And when it became clear that we were quite good and quite serious about it, we got some individual lessons. And then particularly my brother and I, we took it much more seriously and eventually became professional musicians. And it was the most important thing in my life. In a way, one of the ways that I think I'm betraying my heart is by not allowing myself to really continue that. You know, there's part of me that would just like to leave everything behind and then spend all my time meditating and playing Bach. And it feels my first language and I'm not really speaking it much, But I also know that along the way, I didn't come from a musical lineage. There's lots of families where people have been playing from generation to generation. None of my family really knew nothing about it. So I didn't really know the best ways of pursuing it and pursuing the career or developing my skills. But I also was scared, I think I'm a good musician and I think I was talented and I got by a lot by learning from others, and because I think underlying I had a, well, I think, yeah, that recognizing something really deep in the music and resonating with other people who had that, because you can learn an instrument just as a craft, if you put in the time, you've got a good teacher, anyone can learn to play an instrument. And there are some amazing, musicians in terms of their technical facility that musically I just would not ever want to listen to, And there's some other people who might not have those skills, but there's something that's being communicated, something in their heart that is different. So I think I had that side, but then I didn't necessarily put in the work or have the skills or pursue what I needed to do to become as good as I could. I think I always had work as a musician and I was playing with really good people, and a lot of really amazing musicians actually sometimes would ask me to come and play chamber music with them and things like that. And I knew that I wasn't up to the same level as them. And then rather than actually finding ways to make sure that I could get to that level, I just kind of, in a way, would withdraw because I didn't want to sort of be ashamed when they discovered that I wasn't as good as I should be, you know. And I didn't, you know, in a way, I was aware, for instance, oh, there's this really good viola teacher up in Manchester, and there's this other really good one in Amsterdam. And rather than try and find a way of getting to have lessons with them, I just kind of thought, well, I can't do that. And I just got into playing professionally and not studying further in order to get myself to where I could be. So that was one sort of way that I think I did that. And then in the music profession, I was following my heart, doing something that was the most important to me. But I also then came up against, well, you can have the ideals, but then what's it like actually in the profession? You know, when a lot of orchestras are being run for money and that you're doing concerts on 3 hours or 6 hours rehearsal with people you may never have played with before and pieces you may never have played before. You know, and you know, if you're up to a certain standard of playing, then you can get by and do an acceptable performance, but you're never really going to do one that's pretty, you know. Well, I suppose what you want, where you're really in tune with the music, with the other musicians, with the audience. Sometimes that happens, and when that happens, it's just absolutely amazing experience. But a lot of the concerts you do are not like that. And I just get more and more frustrated and grumpy and angry and and just knowing that that wasn't, well, you know, and I would get really worked up about, in a way, betraying. I wouldn't have used those language that language, but I think now in this context, I think I would feel that I was betraying people like Mozart and Schubert and Bach when we played bad performance, and that was kind of painful. And if I heard and if I saw other people doing things that I thought were, I would get really, really angry. Not very skillful. Anyway. But yes, I mean, I think for me, a lot of my life I was sort of scared of listening to my heart, doing lots of things that were important to me, or I did it secretly. I think a lesson for me that really resonated is my mother, who actually was a very, very talented photographer at a time when women weren't really doing that. She used to skive school and go to matinees of the opera and ballet and got really in love with that. And then she got a stage photographer to take her on as an apprentice. And she actually ended up taking photographs of a lot of really leading singers and ballets in that time, just for a period of about 3 or 4 years. I was really surprised a few years ago to realise that actually she's known and that some of the photos she took, you know, are collectible in that kind of way. But I suppose the reason I'm thinking that is because, you know, she was the one that had a successful career, and she got married to my father, my adoptive father, and he was unemployed and didn't really have any skills. But because of the timing of that, you know, she was the wife. She gave up her career and didn't do any of that, and that was the end of her career, really. And she never went back to it. Yeah. And I think there were so many women at that time who did that. Yes, I think we're very, you know, we need to really appreciate the opportunities we have now, which weren't there before. But I think for me, when she, especially when she died, I very much felt she had so many skills, so many qualities. And yeah, I mean, I think she gave a lot to the family and to her friends. But she didn't allow herself to fulfill her creative potential, you know, and other potential I think that she did have. And I think for me, there's also a sense, well, if I'm going to die, I might as well die having done the things that are important to me. So I think that was the beginning of me actually starting a process of exploration, which included training as a massage therapist and healer and working in that field, doing a 4-year training as a counsellor, doing some of that, really deciding I wanted to work with kids, so training as a teacher and working in primary schools and nurseries, before I eventually came to work at the Buddhist Centre. And they may all seem very different, but in each of those, I was kind of following my heart. There were things about, I think there were certain things they shared in common, but in a way, it was just there was something about wanting meaningful connection, wanting to be able to offer something, opportunities for my own and others' sort of healing and development that I think all of those offered. And I'm aware there's times when I just didn't listen to my heart and I just stayed in situations where I was just closing it down and closing it down. I mean, I think by the time I left the teaching profession, it was because there's so much sadness, really, because I love the kids, I really enjoyed the families, but over the course of years, what you could actually do in the schools and what you could do to support them, and you knew the values, and it became so much around testing and SATs, and you would might know what each kid would need to, but it was very hard to be able to offer it to them, and then that created a kind of dissonance in me. It kind of felt in a way like I was betraying them. So I wanted to stay there and see what I could do. But at a certain point, I just realised actually I'm not having as much impact here as I would like to, and it's really, really hurting me, So I moved away from that. And it's interesting because like lots of people thought I was completely crazy, because at that point I'd kind of gone up the, I'd had a certain number of years of experience, I was on sort of management scale, and having had a lot of jobs where I'd been self-employed, I actually had a salary and pension and all those kinds of things. And then I went to work for a very chaotic little Buddhist centre, and my income was like a third of what it was. But I have been so much happier. It's not to say that everything at the Buddhist Centre is always, wonderful. People are people, there's dukkha everywhere. But I've been able to do what's meaningful to me and have a lot of meaningful connection and be following my values. And that, to me, is such a gift. I know it's not possible for everyone, but that I was able to do that, and I have never regretted that, actually. So now I've been talking. I'm going to stop in a minute, but I just did want to sort of follow up a little bit on one of the things that came up yesterday was in around speaking out, speaking our truth. Because yes, sometimes we don't say what's important to us, but I think it's quite nuanced because sometimes it's not actually safe to do that. So I think the Buddha gave a lot of guidance around when to speak and when not to speak. The key thing is it going to be beneficial, beneficial for you to others? But then he also talked about the timing of it. It could be truthful, maybe it's welcome, maybe it's not welcome. That's still, you still say things if they're truthful and they're not welcome, but only if they're going to be beneficial. And you need to pick the right time. So he actually at some point describes, you might know something that's true, but you might wait years to say it till it can be heard, and which reminds me a little bit of like when you're doing counselling and therapy, the idea of well, in the psychodynamic school, that you give an interpretation or you say something that helps somebody see something or get an insight, but you can't just tell them that. You have to wait till they're actually at the point of having that realization, and then maybe just say something that captures that, which then they can understand or they see it. So it's and again, you can wait months, years before it's the right time to say something, because if you say something at the wrong time, you just get them reactive or whatever, or defensive. We probably all know that in our own lives, isn't it? But yes, I mean, particularly, it's been interesting because I've been doing a lot of events for people of colour recently, and we've been exploring the theme of silence and speaking out and all our patterns around that in one of these spaces. And, you know, for a lot of people, actually, speaking out has been very catastrophic, or they've seen other people be really harmed by it. So I think we do need to have some self-meta in all of this. And in fact, self-meta, I think, is really key to not betraying our heart as well. So being kind to ourselves, being compassionate to ourselves, is really key to not betraying ourselves in a way. If we push ourselves past our limits, force ourselves to do things, that's not necessarily listening to our heart. At the same time, being complacent and not allowing ourselves to stretch and challenge ourselves and realise our potential is also between our heart. So I think I'm going to just leave us with a reading. It's from a woman called Marianne Williamson. It's, you might have heard quoted in quite a famous speech by Nelson Mandela some years back. Which I think is all about us having the courage to actually allow ourselves to be all we can be. I mean, Buddhism is so pragmatic in some ways, and it's saying that, you know, until we're enlightened, we're going to be unskillful, we will be experiencing craving and greed, and we will be experiencing ill will and hatred and aversion, and we will have delusion and ignorance and being acting out our patterns and things, and that's what we're practicing with. But it also says that we all have the qualities of the Buddha, we all have that innate Buddha nature, the seeds that we can grow to be just like the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas, you know. And do we really believe that? Sometimes I do, but mostly I don't, I think, if I'm really honest. But I have got to realise that I do have qualities and be able to own my qualities and more positive qualities. Rejoice in some of that even sometimes. So it's interesting, this combination of fear and confidence in practice and giving, actually, because there's this idea in Buddhism that one can give the gift of confidence and fearlessness. And I think the two main ways we do that is, one is actually being there for others, not judging, seeing them, accepting all of their bits, and also being able to rejoice in their positive qualities and maybe help them see those when they're not able to see them for themselves. Encourage them to, you know, develop their potential, do the things that are what they need to do. And I think the other side of that is, when we do that, we give an example and we also give other people permission to do that, or that, or see that it's possible. Yeah. So I'll just end with this reading from Marianne Williamson. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. So I just invite you to see if you can allow yourself to shine. Allow yourself to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous. Not to shrink around others. Not to hide your abilities around others. Just allow yourselves to explore, develop, express your potential, that Buddha nature, all those qualities you've got. And we're all different. So what are the ways that you can shine? What are the particular qualities that you need to grow, express, develop? Okay. So before we have our break, we're going to do a puja, which is a ritual, sometimes translated as worship, but basically, we're in a way, we're trying to connect with those other dimensions, those other qualities, as expressed by the Buddha and other enlightened beings. We're trying to connect with our inspiration and our aspiration on our, you know, not least that we want to be like that, that we have that potential to be like that. You know, the puja we did yesterday had those lines, the Buddha was born as we are born. What the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. What the Buddha attained, we too can attain. And there's that implicit in any puja, you know, is that it's not that we're putting the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas up on a pedestal and we're just sort of, you know, honouring them. Well, we are honouring them. We are honouring them. But it's also honouring our own potential, acknowledging our own potential to be like them. And there's something in ritual, there's a sort of letting go of the ego and the rational mind, because actually we can't fully transform just with our egos, actually. Often our egos can get in the way at a certain point of us, yeah, so really growing and developing. There's so much more to us than this, you know, in a way we perceive ourselves as a certain person and maybe quite fixed with that, and that is one of the delusions that we're working with. So there's something in a ritual sometimes we do that just kind of like surrendering to that. And allowing ourselves to connect with that shraddha, that resonance with things that are meaningful. Maybe you like the chants of the mantra, maybe you like the image or a particular statue, or maybe words, or maybe it's just like expression of your own practice that you can express through the ritual. You know, and yeah, in terms of the Buddha, yes, we do need to discover our own way of connecting to the Buddha, what the Buddha means to us, what the Buddha looks like to us. Find the Buddha in our own imaginations, in a way, express it in ways that are meaningful to us. But definitely there is that sense that we also need to bring in all of ourselves in our practice, that we can't just do it through will and direction. So the effort that we're putting into our spiritual development also needs to be directed towards the whole psyche and developing, growing that psyche, healing that psyche, unifying our energies, including our unconscious energies. And one of the ways we do that is through symbol, archetype, myth, imagination, devotion, which is all something that can you know, be expressed or explored within ritual. Again, Sangharakshita, who's our teacher, has said very clearly that the rational approach will not do it on its own. We do need to bring in all those different sides of ourselves. So, if you'd like to get yourself in a sort of more meditative posture or whatever you do for when you're doing a ritual, and maybe you've never done a ritual before, in which case, do feel to join in and do feel free not to join in. And it's a practice just like other practice. I mean, puja in a way is a practice specifically where we're trying to cultivate faith and devotion. Just as, you know, mindfulness might be, we're trying to cultivate more clarity and metta, cultivate more love and kindness. And they're all part of the path, all part of our practice. So puja is very much about trying to cultivate that faith, devotion, emotional connection to what is most meaningful and valuable to us, to our dreams, our aspirations, our Buddha nature. So I'm just going to get my bell. Oops. Sorry, pottering about there. But you'll okay. So just a moment. Quiet. Settling down. It's always good to connect with the body and the breath. Feeling our connection with the earth, our connection with the world and all the other living beings all around the world. Maitri Pushpa, would you do this in call and response with me? Thank you. Right. And, okay. Buddha Puja. Praise. He is calm like the earth that endures.
He is calm like the earth that endures.
He is steady like a column that is firm.
He is steady like a column that is firm.
He is pure like a lake that is clear.
He is pure like a lake that is clear.
He is free from samsara.
He is free from samsara.
The endless round of suffering.
The endless round of suffering.
In the light of his vision.
In the light of his vision.
He has found true freedom.
He has found true freedom.
His thoughts are peace.
His thoughts are peace.
His words are peace.
His words are peace.
And his work is peace.
And his work is peace.
Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakyamuni 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 Swaha. Shakyamuni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Mahamuni. Shakyamuni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Mahamuni. Shakyamuni Swaha. Salutation. By what earthly path?
By what earthly path?
Could you lead the Buddha astray?
Could you lead the Buddha astray?
He who can wander the pathless ways of the infinite.
He who can wander the pathless ways of the infinite.
The Buddha who is awake.
The Buddha who is awake.
Whose victory cannot be reversed.
Whose victory cannot be reversed.
Is a being none can conquer.
Is a being none can conquer.
One of true vision is not easy to find.
One of such true vision is not easy to find.
Freed from craving, hatred, and delusion.
Freed from craving, hatred, and delusion.
A Buddha is a guide to be treasured.
A Buddha is a guide to be treasured.
Going for refuge. People in fear.
People in fear.
Flee for refuge to mountains or forests.
Flee for refuge to mountains or forests.
To groves, sacred trees or shrines.
Groves, sacred trees or shrines.
But these are not a safe refuge.
But these are not a safe refuge.
They are not a refuge that frees from sorrow.
They are not a refuge that frees from sorrow.
One who goes for refuge to the Buddha.
One who goes for refuge to the Buddha.
To the truth teachings.
To the truth teachings.
And to the community he taught.
And to the community he taught.
They go indeed to a great refuge.
They go indeed to a great refuge.
That is a safe refuge.
That is a safe refuge.
A haven of wisdom and compassion.
A haven of wisdom and compassion.
Those who go to that refuge.
Those who go to that refuge.
Will eventually be free from sorrow.
Will eventually be free from sorrow.
Acknowledging unskillfulness. Hold not a fault of little matter.
Hold not a fault of little matter.
Thinking, this is minor to me.
Thinking, this is mine.
The falling of drops of water.
The falling of drops of water.
Will in time fill a water jar.
Will in time fill a water jar.
In the same way.
In the same way.
Foolish people become full of delusion.
Foolish people become full of delusion.
Though they gather it little by little.
Though they gather it little by little.
Focus not on the flaws of others.
Focus not on the flaws of others.
Nor on their deeds or misdeeds.
Nor on the deeds or misdeeds.
Focus instead on what we ourselves regret.
Focus instead on what we ourselves regret.
What we have done or not done.
What we have done or not done.
Neither in the sky.
Neither in the sky.
Nor deep in the ocean.
Nor deep in the ocean.
Nor in a mountain cave.
Nor in a mountain cave.
Nor any other worldly place.
Nor any other worldly place.
Can we avoid our unskillful actions?
Can we avoid our unskillful actions?
Rejoicing. Oh, let us live in joy.
Oh, let us live in joy.
Kindly among those who blame.
Kindly among those who blame.
Among those who hate, let us live in love.
Among those who hate, let us live in love.
Among those who fight, let us live in peace.
Among those who fight, let us live in peace.
Among those who crave, let us live content.
Among those who crave, let us live content.
Among those who slumber, let us live awake.
Among those who slumber, let us live awake.
When we know the balm of solitude.
When we know the balm of solitude.
And experience the relief of silence.
And experience the relief of silence.
Then we are free from fear and sorrow.
Then we are free from fear and sorrow.
And feel the joy of the Dharma.
And feel the joy of the Dharma.
It is a delight to see the noble and ethical.
It is a delight to see the noble and ethical.
Contact with them inspires and gladdens us.
Contact with them inspires and gladdens us.
Awake and watchful. The followers of Buddha Gautama.
The followers of Buddha Gautama.
Are awake and ever watchful.
Are awake and ever watchful.
And ever by night and by day.
And ever by night and by day.
They remember the Buddha, their teacher.
They remember the Buddha. Their teacher.
The followers of Buddha Gautama.
The followers of Buddha Gautama.
Are awake and ever watchful.
Are awake and ever watchful.
And ever by night and by day.
And ever by night and by day.
They find joy in deep contemplation.
They find joy in deep contemplation.
this being that becomes. From the arising of this.
From the arising. From the rising of this.
That arises.
That arises.
This not being. That does
this
not.
Not this not being, that does not become.
From the ceasing of this, that ceases.
From the ceasing of this, that ceases.
And that's a good example of this being and that becoming. Me not having talked this through with Bhaitri Pushpa in advance. Anyway, so I just want to read the verse in one go and take a moment to reflect on it. This being that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. Transference of benefit. As from a large garden of flowers.
As from a large garden of flowers.
Many garlands and wreaths can be made.
Many garlands and wreaths can be made.
So by a human being in this life.
So by a human being in this life.
Much good can be achieved.
Much good can be achieved.
May any merit.
May any merit.
Gained through Dharma practice.
Gained through Dharma practice.
Be shared equally among all beings.
Be shared equally among all beings.
The perfume of flowers.
The perfume of flowers.
Goes not against the wind.
It was not against the wind.
Not even the finest perfumes.
Not even the finest perfumes.
Of sandalwood, of rose, or of jasmine.
Of sandalwood, of rose, or of jasmine.
But the perfume of virtue.
Perfume of virtue.
Does travel against the wind.
Does travel against the wind.
And it can reach right to the ends of this world.
And it can reach right to the ends of this world.
Muni, Muni, Shakya Muni, Shakya Muni, Sadhu. Muni, sorry.
Muni, Muni, Mahamuni, Shakyamuni, Sadhu. Muni, Muni, Mahamuni, Shakyamuni, Sadhu.
Muni, Muni, Mahamuni, Shakyamuni, Sadhu. Muni, Muni, Mahamuni, Shakyamuni, Shakyamuni Sadhu Muni Muni Mahamuni Shakyamuni Sadhu Muni. So we're going to have a break now, and I invite you to come back for a silent cup of tea or coffee or whatever, if you want to with others, or if you just want to take some time out, that's fine too. As we move towards the final part of this morning's session, So we're going to have a period of just sitting. So you may or may not have done this practice before, but it's basically just what it says on the tin, we're just sitting. It's a receptive practice, and a practice where we're just, you know, like creating space for whatever emerges, not trying. So often we bring our striving into our meditation practice, or want to achieve things, have sort of goals and things, and there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, some of the practices were explicitly trying to cultivate more mindfulness, more kindness. But in this one, we're just being open, receptive, trying to be there with whatever is. You know, seeing what's there in our experience. Allowing ourselves to be who we are, how we are, trying not to judge, just, you know, just being with ourselves. It's always good to balance some of the sort of meditations when we are maybe being a bit more active, trying to make something happen. Though even in those, I think it's always good to bring in a receptive approach. But if we are doing practices like the Metta Bhavana and the mindfulness breathing, it's also good alongside those to include some just sitting. We often like to have structure, but it's quite nice. Well, not just nice, but I think it's quite important that we don't always have structure or do our meditations in the same way. Yeah. Create that potential space where whatever is there may emerge, where we can actually listen to ourselves, listen to our hearts more deeply. So I'm going to read a poem by Orion Mountain Dreamer, and then after that we'll just go straight into a period of just sitting. So it'll be about 20 minutes. And feel free to choose whatever posture works for you. If you want to be sitting or lying, that's fine. So you don't have to be literal with the just sitting. You could think of it as just lying, if you're lying there. What if there is no need to change? No need to try and transform yourself into someone more compassionate, more present, more loving, more wise? How would this affect all the places in your life where you are endlessly trying to be better? What if the task is simply to unfold, to become who you already are in your essential nature? Gentle, compassionate, and capable of living fully and passionately present? What if the question is not, why am I so infrequently the person I really want to be? But, why do I so infrequently want to be the person I really am? What if becoming who and what we truly are happens not through striving and trying, but by recognizing and receiving the people and places and practices that offer us the warmth of encouragement we need to unfold? How would this shape the choices you make about how to spend today? What if you knew that the impulse to move in a way that creates beauty in the world will arise from deep within and guide you every time you simply pay attention and wait. How would this shape your stillness, your movement, your willingness to follow this impulse to just let go and dance? Just sitting. It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. That great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Already the first branch tips brush at the window. Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. Okay, so we'll end there. Thank you for coming and practicing. And our next session is at 4 o'clock. So we'll be starting with groups, about 25 minutes. Actually, literally, we're going to start with the mantra and then we'll have the groups. And then there'll be some Q&A time. And then Maitri Pushpa will lead us in a bit of practice at the end of the session. So if you know you're not going to make it, or you definitely don't want to come to a group, maybe you could just post it in the chat before you leave. You know, don't feel forced to do that, and it might not be right for your practice, but on the other hand, it is a nice way of connecting up with people and sharing, exploring some of your experience. Is there anything else might we push back? Okay. Well, have a nice lunch, afternoon. It looks like, at least in London, it's a nice day. So, or it might be morning for you. I don't know where everybody is in their time zones, but anyway, it might be nice to get out in nature, have a little bit of a walk, or just follow your heart and do whatever feels the right thing.